So when you're sitting peacefully, then I'll begin. Questions today. It's very rare for me to get headaches, but my head is really pounding the past 2 days. May I have been trying too hard to not try too hard. Yeah. That's always the case. Now, if a headache, it may have physical symptoms. Make sure you're drinking enough water. You know, you're not sort of eating the right food. So it's not indigestion. It hasn't got any physical reasons. And then usually if it's coming from meditation, it always is you're trying far too hard. It could be, again, you may be focusing on the tip of your nose. Don't focus on the tip of your nose. Because you do that again. That focusing is trying. It's just concentrating. And concentration gives you headaches. Imagine you're at school. Concentrate, concentrate, concentrate. Of course that gives you headaches. So that's why even at school you have playtime. So playtime for you means go and get yourself a cup of tea, have a walk in the bush. And so when you get very tense, loosen up. This is a problem with too many people these days. I know this is an old story, but I always remember hearing the story about the man who went to the psychiatrist. He said, "What's your problem?" He said, "Sometimes I think I'm a marquee. Sometimes I think I'm a teepee." And he said, "I haven't heard that before. You mean a marquee?" "I've got it," he said. "Sometimes you think you're a marquee, sometimes you think you're a teepee. It's obviously you're too tense." Takes you a long time to get this. You really are dull. It's too much slop and torpor. But that's what happens when you're tense. You're too tense. You know, a marquee is a type of tent. A teepee is another tent. So sometimes you think you're marquee, sometimes you're teepee, you are too tense. I give up. If you can't see the jokes, you never see Anatta. Your discerning wisdom's not such. So headaches means you're trying too hard, for certain. And why do you try too hard? Because you're afraid of what might happen if you let go. So remember, all fear causes control, and that's where the headaches come from. So you've got nothing to fear. There's nobody in here. You've got nothing to lose. You never had anything to begin with. So, anyway. Dear Ajahn, please help me. No. People ask me to say no every now and again. Okay. I have a problem holding grudges. About 10 years ago, when the nuns' monastery started, my girlfriend and I were very excited. We decided to go and give dana. We cooked beautiful food and we arrived 25 minutes early. We went to offer the food. The nuns scolded us for being early. I burst into tears and I've never been back. Other women have also had bad experiences. Do not go anymore. How do I let go of this fear of being scolded? You are so fortunate to be scolded. You know, there was this story. This is actually from the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha. And there was a man was going to the palace. So he was actually trying to get a contract, you know, from the king. So that's like from the government. So it's worth a lot of money. He thought he had a good chance to get this contract and make a lot of money for his business. So he was wearing his very best clothes. This was in the time of the Buddha. And he went early in the morning. He walked past the nuns' monastery. And as he was walking on the other side of the wall, you know, to the nuns' monastery, that was the time that one of the nuns, whose job it was to empty the latrines. They didn't have like these sewage systems. It all went into a bucket. So she decided to throw the bucket over the monastery wall. And he just happened to be walking on the other side. And he got a bucket of shit on his head. And he was in his best clothes about to see the king. So he had a grudge. He said, "Those nuns, they're not real nuns. No, they're just prostitutes," he called them. "Not real nuns. I'm going to teach them a lesson. Look what they've done to me." Now, in those days, all the monasteries were made out of wood. So he got a torch and he went into the monastery to burn that monastery down. How could they do this to him? That was really filthy. But there was a gatekeeper at the entrance. He said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Look what happened to me. I got this bucket of shit from one of the nuns and I'm going to burn that monastery down." And he said, "That's auspicious." wow, that's... I've got to say this. Holy shit. Those come from really great meditators and nuns. Now that is really, really lucky. Well, some of you lay people are very stupid because you say, really? Is that the case? He said, yes, really, really lucky. Not everybody gets that. You know, these are great meditators over here. So it's like being blessed. So look, said the gatekeeper, put away that torch, go home, get changed, get washed, you know, and get a new pair of clothes. I'm sure that something wonderful is going to happen today for you. Oh, really? So he went home, he got showered, you know, got changed, went to the palace, and he actually got awarded the contract. And he went around telling everybody, it's very lucky to get a bucket of big hoony shit on top of you. So, this is true, you can read it, you know, this is actually what it says. And so when the Buddha heard about this, you know, he realized that that was a very, very clever gatekeeper who got the nuns out of a lot of trouble. But then he laid down a rule, one of the Paccitya rules for the bhikkhunis. And you can read it, it's there today. You shall not throw buckets of shit over the monastery wall. And that's one of the 311 rules. They got away with it once, thanks to a very clever gatekeeper. You won't get away with it again. So he was scolded by a holy nun. Wow, that was auspicious. You are so lucky. I'm sure that later on that day something wonderful happened to you. Maybe. So when it happens, you know, you get scolded. But, you know, just, oh, it's just hot air which comes out of the mouth. So don't hold grudges. That was 10 years. Have they been there that long? 10 years. Gee, that was a long time. I'm getting old. But anyway, 10 years, why are you holding a grudge? One of my sayings is never allow other people to control your happiness. So whatever people say, that's their business. I'm not going to get unhappy what other people say about me. Because, you know, people do call you names. They do say rotten things about you. No matter who you are, there's always somebody who don't like you. So don't let other people. So anyway, so your girlfriend were excited and decided to go and give dana, cook beautiful food and arrive 25 minutes early. They must be sort of have a lot of food in that monastery because therefore it was me 25 minutes. Actually, it depends what food you offered. If it was fish and chips, 25 minutes early, an hour early, oh, I'd sort of praise you. I'd give you a blessing there and then. Now, as I give them, they may be in a bad mood that day, so I cut them some slack. Because, you know, it's, we don't give, whenever you give food to like the Sangha, you're not giving it to the person, it's to the Sangha. So it's not to one particular nun who scolded you, it's to the idea of nuns who want to support the bhikkhunis. So we can have a very strong bhikkhuni sangha. We've gone a long way to start this thing off. And it's very, you know, it's very difficult to start a bhikkhuni sangha, to get the land, to get the people to stay there, to build things up, you know, to ordain the bhikkhunis. That caused a lot of trouble which you had to bear with. We got so far. So, you know, let's build it up now. So, you know, we don't want to sort of stop supporting at this stage, you know, when we're trying to get more nuns, more ordinations, more bhikkhunis. It's a wonderful thing. Where's Upeka? Where's Upeka gone? She's going to ordain soon. Must be in jhana. She's here this morning. Anyway. There we go. There's a recommendation. So, yeah, try again. Yeah. Give people another chance. Usually three times in Buddhism you do things. You bow three times. You know, you say sort of Namo Tassa three times. So, you know, get scolded three times. You only done once, okay? You won't get scolded these days. No, so you're okay. You're rocking up for dana early all the time. So it's great. So it's now a scold-free monastery. Yes, very good. So you're safe there. So just please go back again. Because she lives there. She's hungry. And you don't have to be a woman to go to the nuns' monastery, because actually most people who feed the monks are women. So actually, it should be most people who feed the nuns should be men. So anyway, just go up there and have a nice time. It's a beautiful monastery. How can you see the Dharma with only second jhana or not see consciousness cease? The way you actually see it, because so much has ceased by the time you get into second jhana, you can actually see much of consciousness has ceased. Sight consciousness has gone, sound consciousness, smell, taste, body consciousness, they've all disappeared. Now, first of all, you also see from this what mind consciousness truly is. As I said, you can't really know something till the other things disappear. And now, this is mind consciousness. What's left when all of the five other senses have disappeared? Remember that simile of the emperor I gave in the beginning? You know, you've got to take the emperor's clothes off before you actually see what's underneath. So you have to take the five senses off before you find out what the mind truly is. So now in this jhana, you've got just the mind. You can see it's already something disappeared to go from the first to the second jhana. And it's almost you can see from this point that consciousness, the knowing, is about to disappear. You understand when things become still, all consciousness vanishes. You've got five gone, and you can usually go through inference to get the other insight that even the mind disappears. So that's possible from the second jhana. And this is actually what the Buddha says. You know, first jhana is the minimum. Second, third, fourth jhana, fifth, three immaterial jhanas. But the first jhana is the minimum to become enlightened. If you don't believe me, that's in the 64th sutta, Maha Malunkya Putta Sutta, number 64 of the Majjhima Nikaya. It's impossible, said the Buddha, to actually become enlightened without getting the jhanas. Just like it's impossible to get to the heartwood of a tree without first going through the bark and the sapwood. Very, very clear. You can't make it clearer than that. If you can find a way to get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and sapwood, let me know. And maybe you can also find a way to get enlightened without going through the jhanas. That's a Buddhist simile. Imagine verse 64. Devachan, Angulimala should not be labelled as a murderer, as he was only following his teacher's orders. He was a very intelligent and obedient student and was a victim of a plot by fellow jealous students. When the teacher told him to bring a garden of 1,000 toes, he thought Angulimala would be killed in the process. Angulimala was lucky the Lord Buddha saved him from killing his mother, who was on her way to meet him. Otherwise, Angulimala, who had the merits to be an arhat, would have been in hell for a very long time. Okay, I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, was he responsible for all the killings he did? Or was it because he followed instructions? Did he have to follow instructions? So whose fault was it? Remember in the Nuremberg trials, many of those the generals in the German army who did terrible, terrible things, especially to the people in the concentration camps. By concentration camps, I don't mean meditation retreat centers. I mean the real places. That was the defense which they had. They were just following orders. And that was deemed to be not sufficient to absolve you of responsibility. That's a very interesting, you know, does it really mean if you follow orders? And if your teacher, if I tell you to go and kill the person who wrote this question, would you be culpable? Of course you would. Now, if you did it, you would. So just following orders is not good enough, because even in Buddhism, we take responsibility for our actions. So Angulimala, you could see that he had, you know, some ameliorating reasons that, you know, why he did that, but still you chose to kill. So you take the responsibility for that. So I've got to be very, very careful, because sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm told me to do it. That's it. Somebody told me that this happened in England, in one of the nuns' monasteries, that one of the nuns was giving guidance to the Anagarika who was driving, and she said, just go straight ahead at the roundabout. They went right over the roundabout, straight ahead. They're following orders. That's why you've got to be very careful as a teacher. Some people, whatever you say, they follow orders to the letter, and I get in big trouble. You just tell people, look, let go, don't do anything. And they do their toilet right where they're sitting. That's not what I meant. So you've got to be very careful. So when you listen to instructions, you have to use your intelligence, for goodness sake. But Angulimala, yeah, you can see he had an excuse there. He was following his teacher, but you don't always have to follow that teacher. Here's a nice little story, which I read a long time ago. This is actually from the Jataka Tales. There was, in those days, the teachers had many students, and obedience was important, but not absolute. So one day this teacher, he got all his students together, he had maybe about a dozen or 15 students, but he also had a very beautiful daughter. This is that time, when all the guys liked the daughters, and daughter didn't have any chance to, who she would marry. It was always arranged marriages. So it's a bit sexist, but it's a great story anyway, so here we go. So he brought all the students together and said, look, my daughter is of marriageable age now, and according to our custom, I have to marry her to one of the students. She's a very beautiful girl. I know you all like to marry her, but I have a problem. First of all, choosing which of you should marry my daughter, but also the problem is that I'm very poor. So I can't actually give you any money to start your life together. So I came up with a solution. He said, what I want you to do, I want you to go and steal from the nearby villages. And whoever steals the most will marry my daughter, and they will get, all the combined wealth which you get from stealing from the village. And I said, but make sure that no one sees you steal, because I don't want any of you to get caught. And that's the instructions. And we give you a week. Whoever steals the most will get my daughter. And as long as no one sees you stealing, and all the money, all the goods will go to the winner. And actually the students were really, really surprised, because their teacher was a very honest, good person. And now he was asking them to steal. But the obedience was such. And they all wanted a daughter. So they all snuck into the village late at night. They'd only go in the houses when they thought no one was there or they were all asleep, because they had to follow the instructions that no one would see you. And whenever they brought all the goods back, the teacher would actually catalogue them. From what house did you get that from? And who actually stole it? So he could actually put it all together and keep a good record. And after the 7 days, he brought all the students together. He said, you've stolen so many things. You've been very obedient. Except one of you, who hasn't stolen anything. Why? And this poor young student said, but I was obedient, teacher. What do you mean? I followed your instructions, he said. I went to the village late at night, sometimes very early in the morning. And I went into the houses when no one was there. And I was about to steal something, but I remembered your instructions. Don't steal if someone's watching you. Someone was watching me. Me. I was watching me. That's why I couldn't steal. And their teacher said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. At least I've got one clever student amongst all you stupid ignoramuses. He said, I want you to take all that stuff back to the houses. Here's the list. You won't get punished because I told the villagers a week ago to expect you. This was a test to see of your wisdom. And only one passed. I'm rich enough as it is, he says. And now this young man who was wise, who understood whenever you take something, there's always somebody watching. You're watching you. He's wise enough to marry my daughter. And may they live happily ever after, which they did. Well, that's a great story there, because follow instructions. Sometimes you don't follow instructions properly. There's always somebody watching you. You are. So you can never get away with anything. You can't do anything in secret, because you're looking. So that's a nice little story. I tell that to kids a lot. So anyway, with Angulimala, he's still... That's not the right instructions. So even if somebody tells you to kill, no. So, but he wasn't a murderer. He was a person who murdered. I often say that if you go into jails, I never see thieves, I never see murderers, I never see rapists, I see people who have raped, people who have stolen. And it's a totally different perception if you see that's a person who has cheated and not a cheat. In other words, Angulimala was a person who'd murdered. He wasn't a murderer. If he was a murderer, there's no way you can get enlightened. But if you're a person who's murdered, there's a whole other part of you. And that's the part which can get enlightened. So, after talking about Angulimala, the question comes, can you become enlightened? Have you got what it takes to become enlightened? Look, a serial killer became enlightened. Surely you can. Ajahn, many years ago my sister was mentally and physically abused by Catholic nuns. How can I help her recover? It's, you know, that sometimes that when you keep bringing up past, you just allow that past to fester. Sometimes the best way, and I know this goes against modern psychology, but this is Buddhist psychology, you just learn to totally let it go. You don't need to sort of be punished anymore. Because this is basically how it works. You know, you think about those nuns who punished you. And every time you remember it, they're punishing you one more time. If you can only let it go, then the punishment is over. And the problem is, why is it we can't let it go? Number one, we're not encouraged to let it go. We're always encouraged to revisit it. You go through therapy, bring it up, what happened. Is that really helpful? In Buddhism, we teach people how to let go. That's what you've been doing this last 8 or 9 days, 7 days, or however long it's been. You may not have succeeded yet, but you soon can. You can let go of the past, totally. One way of doing that is understanding non-self. It wasn't you. You don't have to make the identity out of that. You can just really move on. The past is a prison cell whose door is always open. You can walk out any time you want. But many people are afraid to walk out of the prison. They're afraid of freedom. Being a victim gives you an identity. And it gives you actually many benefits as well. If it wasn't the benefits of being a victim, you would let it go very quickly. So we have to notice why we want to be victims. There's an excuse for many, many things. It's courageous to give up the identity of the victim. But it's so worthwhile, because otherwise you'll never be free. So thinking of your past like a prison, and thinking that it's a prison cell, you can't do anything with it. You can't make a prison cell into a beautiful apartment. But certainly you can walk out and let it totally go. That's possible to do. And it can be done, and it has been done. As for the nuns, we think, if I let it go, there is no justice. They need to be brought to justice. And of course, that's not justice. That is revenge. And you've got to be very careful between justice and revenge. What most people take to be justice is not revenge. They hurt me, they did bad, therefore they must be punished. And of course, the only person who really gets punished is you. You just make that sort of that pain, that trauma just last a long time. So number one, if you really want justice, it's nothing to do with punishment. If you really want justice for those Catholic nuns who abused you and maltreated you, remember karma. So my old saying, you don't need to seek revenge, because karma will get the bastards anyway, using the old Australian word. And it's that beautiful saying, because it means you don't need to seek for justice. You don't need to bring them to a trial. Karma will work that out for you. So sometimes, this goes against the grain, what other people do. But you know, for the individual, you become free. You can let it go and move on. I remember seeing a study done on, I think it was a big train crash in outside of Paddington, quite a few years ago. And many people got killed, many were injured, and the survivors were offered counselling. Some of them went for counselling, some of them didn't. And I think a year later, some psychologists checked up that people who went for counselling were far more worse off than the people who didn't go for counselling. And that was actually quite shocking, because counselling is supposed to help you. Was it really helping you? Or was it making you cherish the pain? Sometimes counselling can help, can you deal with things, but sometimes it can be counterproductive, can make you cherish the past and make a big thing out of it, instead of learning just how to let it go and walk on. As a Buddhist, you can do that. There is one example which I like quoting. It must have been about 20 years ago or 18, 19 years ago. There's one of the people who would come to one of my meditation classes. Actually, her friend said, "You better speak to this lady, she's in big trouble." So I made the opportunity to approach her and talk with her. Her problem was that week she found out that her husband had been sexually abusing her two children. It had been found out at school. Now, there were signs there. The teacher saw them, interviewed the kids, and found out, yeah, it was a case. They were being sexually abused by her husband. The man she loved was abusing the children she loved. And of course, straight away, she felt terrible guilt that her main duty to protect her children, that she failed. She just didn't see it. And of course, you can understand why a mother just can't see these things. They're so horrible, they're so terrible. You become blind to them. It's called basic denial. Anything which is just so horrible, it takes a long time for you to see and admit to. So straight away, we let go of her guilt. And now she was faced with this man, which she thought she loved and trusted, had done this horrendous thing. So obviously the marriage was ended. The man was eventually had to go to jail. And she had to go to counselling. And had no choice in it. And the counsellor wrote to me, the woman came to see me again after a few weeks and said, "Look, you have to help me. Sort of, you know, I've dealt with this in a good Buddhist way. I've let it go. I've got no anger to that man. I can never love him again. But I don't wish him any punishment or ill will. I'm not seeking revenge. I just let the whole thing go. I've moved on." He said, "But my counsellor would not let me go until I admit I hate the guy and I'm angry at him." I said, "But I'm not angry at him. I don't hate him. And I've really let it go." So I had to contact that counsellor and explain the Buddhist way of doing things and say that woman has let go very, very quickly, much more quickly than you've been used to. She hasn't got anger, she hasn't got ill will. And I kept in touch with that woman. She moved over to England. See, I think it's last year she sent me a Christmas card. One once was abused, is quite happily in a relationship now. She's got grandkids. So it actually did work. She let go and moved on. Because mother moved on so quickly, so did the two kids. She didn't need to keep revisiting it. And I thought that was a wonderful example of a Buddhist way to deal with very, very heavy trauma and abuse. There is another way. Also, you've got to be careful, because if that's not working, someone's denying and hiding it, that's not going to work. But if they do it properly, good Buddhist way is an alternative, which is beautiful. Okay, go on.
I'm going to say this too.
Yeah.
What you're saying is really correct, and I agree with you about issues to do with certain trauma counseling and that sort of stuff, but the thing is that certain people have traumatic injury, and the memories of those particular injuries come back and they are involuntary. So they don't choose to why. When it is that situation, it is the past haunting the present. There's another sort of injury where people wallow, and I agree with all of what you said, but if you assume, and you have people here who may in this group have had traumatic injuries, and you assume that it is, you know, that when it comes back on them initially, crucial in helping them come to terms with, but the idea that they have complete control over those traumatic memories, especially initially, that's generally speaking not the case.
It can be the case, especially if a person actually has a very, very good Buddhist attitude. Because a lot of times, like even when you're meditating, many people come up and say, oh, these thoughts came into my mind. And that's what I always thought, that when you're meditating, just thoughts come from nowhere. Until with greater mindfulness, I see, no, I actually go out seeking those thoughts. And it's just like the past. It doesn't haunt you. You actually go seeking that past. You seek that past because either you think you need to do that, or you expected to do that, or because you haven't got the innate, huge amount of courage to actually just to drop it straight away. And the more that we can encourage to dropping it, the more those pasts will not haunt you. So I get what you're saying, because what I'm saying here is radical, and you have to have a very, very strong Buddhist attitude towards this, and also some very great skills in meditation.
It's interesting what you say, yeah. Because when I've had people who have had mindfulness training skills, who've had a traumatic experience, what you say is true.
Yeah, it can work, yeah. But for people who haven't, then, it's very difficult to do. So it can be done. It's nice to mention what can be done. And if it's for you, you've got some training, you've got some lots of teaching over here, you should be able to at least give that a shot if you've had some very sort of bad traumas in the past. Let it go. Don't grasp, linger, and cherish it. And it's just that very idea that you can let go, for me, was just a beautiful revelation. I don't have to carry the past. And it was just a different way of seeing things. Yeah. Yeah. If you're actually hiding it, that's a totally different matter. Now that's when you have the sort of the trauma sort of in some cupboard somewhere. You haven't thrown it out. You haven't let go of it. You're just ignoring it. So that's a different thing. But it's a great thing to be able just to take the cupboard of all your bad memories and put all of it in the yellow recycling bin and have it taken away. And it's a beautiful thing to actually know you can do that. And some of us, most of us, we've got so many sort of bad memories, so many traumas, it's endless to try and deal with them all. Especially if you start to include some of the things from your past lives, which people from regression can get into. And sometimes it's endless, endless, endless. When will be an end of this? And like an Angulimala, he never went to see a therapist. He learned something very, very powerful to be able to let go of the whole lot. 99 or 999 murders, which should have haunted him. But you can do that. Now, not say that you are able to do that, but what I'm really emphasizing here is that possibility does exist. So, if you really want to, make use of that. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, that was actually when, just after the Angulimala, he basically understood what the Buddha meant by stop. He became a monk, became enlightened, and then one day on alms round, he saw a woman giving birth, and it was a very, very difficult birth. She was in a lot of pain. And so he quickly went to the Buddha and said, can I help her? And the Buddha gave him this chant called the Angulimala protection, which basically was an asseveration of truth. He says, ever since my birth, I haven't harmed or hurt any being. Something like that. He said, I can't say that because I've killed 99 or 999 people. He says, every time since your birth, there's an enlightened being. He said, I can say that. And because he said that, and it was such a powerful thing for someone who was once murdered 99 or 999 people, to be able to say, now I'm harmless. It was an incredibly powerful statement, which is why it worked. Now, monks these days do the Angulimala chant. That doesn't have much power because they haven't been murderers and they haven't become enlightened now. It was actually because of the incredible power of someone who's been a serial killer and now is totally enlightened. And that's an incredible thing. And that's why that statement had a huge amount of power. So anyway, but at that time he could say that. Say, I'm now free. Oh no, it didn't bother him. What bothered him was the fact he thought he was lying. And as an arahant, he could not lie. The kidding never bothered him. That was let go of. But now he thought he was lying. He couldn't say that. And when the Buddha explained what he meant, he said, I can say that. So it was the lie which was bothering him. I took your recommendation and went over to the hall at Bodhinyana this afternoon. It was very peaceful and I meditated deeply for a couple of hours. At one stage I experienced a bright flash like a camera flash. As far as I was aware, nobody was taking pictures at the time. Is this related to nimittas or just energy releasing in my brain? Perhaps it was a nimitta flashing by on its way to one of the other occupants of the room. Oh, why are people just never can accept good stuff? That was your nimitta. Nimittas don't go to the wrong people. They don't get to the wrong address. They came to you. They had your name on it. So that was an imitator, a bright flash, but obviously that, you know, that you reacted there when it happened. And so because you moved, the imitator just vanished again. Its causes were very good. Look, you were very peaceful, you meditated deeply a couple of hours. That's what happens when you're peaceful, you meditate deeply for a couple of hours, you see those lights. But of course it came up, a flash, and then you must have done something to disturb it. So it went away again. So next time, just stay still. And also, don't doubt it, because I don't know how many times people say this. They're meditating in this room in the middle of the night and say, it's the sun shining at me. There's no blooming sun through these windows. There's no one with a camera. There's not a light shining in your face. It's a nimitta. Accept it. You're doing well. Why is it that when, you know, things go badly, oh, accept criticism. But when things go well, and an imitator told, oh no, it can't be, not me. It was you. Well done. That was an imitator. I sometimes feel a loosening sensation around my heart area during meditation. It feels as if my heart is opening up. Yes, opening the door of your heart. It's working. You know, somebody told me, I think it was in Adelaide, they found my book in a shop in Adelaide, in a medical section under surgery. Opening the door of the heart. Some stupid person in the bookshop. Sorry, so this is no cardiac surgery. Anyway, it feels as if my heart is opening up. Does a physical heart have any significance in meditation? It doesn't really have a physical meaning in meditation, but because that's actually how we view, sort of, you know, where our, especially our softness, our center is. So it's just the way the mind is perceived, like an opening up of the heart. It means you're opening up the heart to more metta, to more joy, to more softness, to less hardness. So it is like, this is the way we perceive an opening up of the heart, as if the real heart is opening up. It's not the real heart, it is your metta opening up. So your heart is loosening up. You're making progress. What is metta meditation and how to do it? You sit down, you close your eyes and say, I must have metta. If I don't have metta, I'm going to beat myself. I must have metta. Metta or else. That's not metta meditation. Metta meditation is getting the rabbit and stroking it. Ah, this lovely little rabbit. It's just so cute and it licks you if it likes you. Imagine getting licked by a fluffy little rabbit. Isn't that very beautiful? Isn't that wonderful? So, what do you feel? You feel this beautiful sense of goodwill and love. If it's a pet rabbit or a little child, it means you just want them to be happy and well. You don't ask them for anything. Now, even if that rabbit pees all over your jacket, you don't really mind. It's just a rabbit doing rabbit's things. And it means that, you know, you just love people. You love just a rabbit. You open the door of your heart, rabbit, whatever you do, just thank you so much for letting me stroke you. That's what metta means. So you say that to your breath. Little breath, you know, no matter what you do to me, just I love you so much. You're just so kind. Just the way you brought oxygen into my body all these years and taken all these products out, which, you know, not useful for me. Oh, beautiful breath, I love you so much. You're my best friend. Oh, my stupid mind, you're just being a mind. That's what minds are like. So, oh, I love you, mind. You know, I might as well love you because I'm stuck with you for the rest of the time. So I'm making up. It's all those terrible things I did to you and the terrible things, the way I treated you in the past. Oh, mind, look, I love you. The door of my heart is open to you, mind. No matter what you do, if you fall asleep, if you ask stupid questions from Ajahn Brahm, or if you, you know, you get a nice nimitta and then you blow it by getting excited, whatever it is, my book, it's okay. I will not criticize you, I will not judge you, I will just be your friend. That's like metta. And when you have metta, just the whole world is at peace with you, because the whole world is your friend. You have no enemies. So that's what metta meditation is. If you don't know yet, go and find the rabbit. Venerable Sir, you advise me to practice metta with my breath as a strategy to help still my mind. Even though the breath is the stuff of life, I find it rather abstract to practice metta to it. Please advise me further. Look, you can anthropomorphize. People actually look at all sorts of things. You know, like, you know, their car. You know, sometimes you give your car a name. We had a cement mixer at our monastery years ago, and I was a main builder. That was my cement mixer. And so other people, they couldn't start it. Me, I'd just stroke it a little bit, give it some metta, and I'd pull the cord. It would start every time. You know, just having a bit of metta towards a machine actually worked. But the best story was, you know, an Anagarika who stayed here. He was from Germany. And one day, so actually he was at some college in Germany. And when he first went onto campus, you know, he was passing the ATM machine. And he said, ATM, what he said, it gurgled, it made a noise to him. And he took that, you know, he was a bit of a weirdo, but he took that as I shouldn't say that, you know, that's Michael, yeah. you got it already, Annie Gallagher, to the back. He took that as like a sign of friendship. So whenever he passed that ATM, you know, he would actually give it friendship. And every so often, actually, the ATM would gurgle at him. And, you know, even though it might have had some physical, scientific cause, he took that as like a friendship. And, but he said the killer was one day, sort of he was sitting, just having some lunch by the ATM on a bench. And the ATM gurgled at him. And so he smiled back. And a 20-euro note came out. And he couldn't believe it. Because no one had been close to that ATM for about 10 or 20 minutes. And just out of nowhere, without anybody putting a card in or pressing any buttons, a 20-euro note came out. And he sort of said he took it out, he waved it around, if it belonged to anybody, it belonged to nobody at all. So that's what happens when you're kind to ATMs. You give it loving kindness. Next time you're short of money, find an ATM and stroke it. Nice ATM. I really love you. You're such a beautiful ATM. May all ATMs be happy and well, be free of suffering. May all have lots of money. And see if you're lucky. He said he swears that was true. The ATM, because of loving kindness, gave him 20 bucks. So if you can do that to an ATM, you can do it to your breath. Nice breath. Thank you, lovely breath, for coming in and going out. And it might gurgle at you. And who knows, it may sort of punch out a nimitta or a jhana for you, if you're lucky. So this is the human being. It can take a machine, give it a name, and anthropomorphize. In other words, think it's got a personality. You do that all the time. You know, to me, it's just a machine. But you give me a personality, this Ajahn Brahm. You know, to Dani, the caretaker, she's just a machine. 5 candles, it just works. Just, you're no different than an ATM, Dani. But every now, because I'm kind to her, every now and again, out comes a cup of tea with condensed milk for me. That's how it works. So whether it's a physical machine or the machine called a human being, it's all the same. So with the breath, just be kind to it. Think of it as a being. You can do that. Imagine it as a being. And then you can be kind to it. The pieces of paper left for writing down questions are getting more minute by the minute. Are our questions getting too long-winded? Thank you. Exactly. Because what happened? Look, this is 1-2 questions. This is 1-2-3 questions. Only one question per person. So get your best question instead of having all these long questions. Anyway, could you please explain the present moment again? Oh, goodness. It's now, okay? What's happening right this moment? It's like the difference between watching a rerun and watching something live. Now, then when a movie first comes out, watching it straight away and watching just these reruns on TV, which happen all the time. It's like when you hear the joke for the first time, that's present moment. And when you hear the joke, how many times is this? That's present moment. Present, right here, right now. No past, no future. What's in the middle between the past and the future, that's the present moment. What happens if there are so many disturbances happening at one time? You cannot apply, recognize, familiarize an ease method when there are many distractions at the same moment. There's only one one distraction per moment. That's gone. So that burp went. It's in the past, so forget about it. There's only one disturbance every moment. But sometimes, because we're not in the moment, we collect so many disturbances, put them all together and think that's in the present moment. You only have one disturbance at a time. So you can only attend to one thing at a time. So what's in your mind right now? It's usually the most prominent, the loudest noise, the most interesting sight, or the most enticing flavour, whatever. That's all you see. So the mind chooses that which is most interesting to it. So that's actually all that you are doing, just one at a time. They may change very quickly, but it's always just one at a time. Since my focus goes to the breath, I focus on the breath after discussing at the interview. But it became frustrating. You don't come to silent present non-awareness. It would be only watching the breath, no results only. It's not supposed to be results. Remember what I said at the very beginning of this meditation retreat. Don't try and attain something. Try to let go of things. Just make peace. If you're trying to get somewhere, you'll always be frustrated. Stop wanting. Just let go of wanting. So that you're happy to be here no matter what's happening. And if you have many, many moments of just being happy to be here, being content, you will find that all these peaceful states come by themselves. But if you try to watch the breath, if you try to get peaceful, if you try to get the $20 out of the ATM, no way. You just got to learn how to let things go. And look, I don't care how long it takes, if it's 9, 10 days of retreat, if it's 20 retreats, if your whole life, if you just learn how to let go once, it's well worth it. And to see what happens when you just don't try. When you get out of the way, your sense of self, your pride, your ego, it just vanishes for a short time. And you're just sitting here, and you have peace. Just to do that once is beautiful. Because it tells you what meditation is, what the path of the Buddha is. Going against the stream of craving. Famously, the Buddha put his bowl in the river Niranjana before he became enlightened. He made the resolution, if I'm to become enlightened, may my Buddha go against the current. And it did. That was not just an omen, that was a message on how to become enlightened. Go against the stream of wanting, of controlling, of doing things. Just stop, like Angulimala. Stop. And if you can do that, you get all the deep meditations very easily. If you try to watch the breath, if you try and do this so you can get peaceful, no way. Just learn how just to be peaceful. Stop, let go. Let go of this thing inside which is always pressing buttons and levers. And you go and see, what's the next lever I can do? This one didn't work. Can you tell me another button to press? Can you tell me another sort of wheel I can sort of turn to make it work? I'm telling you, take your hands off all the wheels. Take your feet off all the pedals. Stop pressing the buttons. Leave things alone. And then everything stops. So if you get that message, you'll understand how to meditate. What's wrong with enjoying listening to a nice song while it's playing? How do we know the danger of sensory experience? You get into jhana first. And then you know why enjoying listening to a nice song is not the best way you can use your time. You get into a place where the five senses disappear and you understand, wow, what bliss that was, and why I was wasting my time trying to find happiness in the realm of the five senses. If you have no other experience in prison, you think prison is wonderful. And many people, they're born in prison, lived all their lives in prison, and they think prison's a great place. They've got many friends in prison. Very often you marry another prisoner, and you have many other children in prison. And you've got your nice little business in prison, and the prison's got a nice yard, you know, called Planet Earth, where you can just play around. And, you know, you get nice jobs in prison, and sometimes, you know, you get sort of special privileges because you work very hard and get a bigger prison cell than other people. And sometimes people get this big set of rooms, which is their prison. They've got a little car which they can ride around in prison. But they're still in prison. But because that's all you know, you think, how wonderful, how successful I am. I've got a bigger cell than everybody else. And look at how the possessions I've got in my cell. And all this money which I can use in the prison shop. And then someone comes along and says, you know, there's a world outside prison. And they say, oh, you don't know what they're talking about. Get a life. You know, enjoy prison. It's so wonderful in here. Yeah, you get a bit of pain. The body aches sometimes. And sometimes you have arguments, have divorces. And sometimes you lose your money in prison. But, you know, it's not a bad place if you've got the right attitude. But someone says, it's a prison. There's another place you can get out of the five sense prison. And sometimes people say, oh, let's give this guy a chance. So they go down the tunnel called meditation. In. And they found life outside of prison. Wow, why didn't anybody tell me about this before? I always thought these five senses were the be all and end all of life. So you get into a jhana, it changes your whole life. So that's when you know that listening to a nice song while it's playing, yeah, for this, that's all you know, it's pretty good. But once you know something more, why do I just want this? According to the Buddhist simile, that once there was a man who was born blind. And because he was blind, he didn't really, you know, see very much. But this travelling salesman came to his village and say he was selling Benares cloth, which was like, you know, the best possible sort of material in those days. And he said, this is beautiful cloth from Benares, and everyone was buying it. So the Brahmin said, well, even though I'm blind, I can't see, but other people can see me. I want one too. So he paid a lot of money for this cloth. And some days later, this doctor came through town and he said, well, you know, I can actually cure your blindness, maybe. Give it a try, and his blindness was cured. And so he could see this nice cloth, and he found it wasn't a good Benares cloth. This travelling salesman had noticed he was blind, taken advantage of him, and just sold him an old oily cloth. And the Buddha said, he sold me an old oily cloth, and because I was blind, I thought it was a beautiful piece of cloth. And you get very upset. And the Buddha said, that's what happens when you see Dhamma. All these sounds, sex, beautiful things. You think, how wonderful it is. My mansion, my car, my family, my life. And when your eyes open up, you think, my goodness, someone has sold me something which I thought was so wonderful and beautiful and I cherished. But now I see it for what it truly is. And that's actually what happens. That's when you see all these songs, all these movies, and all that sort of stuff. You see them for what they truly are. Scary, but true. Ajahn, as there are now many more people than places for your retreats, why don't you do what Glastonbury Festival now does and run a lottery system for the issuing of tickets, places? This would ensure everybody has a fair and equal chance of getting on a retreat. So, should we have a lottery for coming on retreats? If there was a lottery, someone would come up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, can we have divine intervention, please? Look, I know, I haven't gone to a retreat for such a long time, and I've got to book a ticket from a long way away, and I've really looked after you whenever you go to London. Now, can you come on, Ajahn Brahm, you can fix it for me. So, actually, we had another idea at the monastery. Now, because we're building like a teacher's kuti, and we need money for the nuns' place as well, we decided to have an auction. Oh no, only the rich people will go there. But we have a nice teacher's cottage. No, we don't do auctions. So we're not quite sure what we're going to do. I don't know what we should do to actually to the next time. How to have enough places here so everyone can go. Like lottery might be good.
Clone you.
Sorry?
Clone you.
Clone me. I don't know, one person telling jokes is enough. Imagine sort of many clones telling bad jokes all the time. They'll all be the same jokes as well, which they say. Anyway, we don't know what to do. But you know, the best thing to do, if you're really concerned about that, about, you know, sort of too many people coming on retreat, stop messing around and get enlightened so you don't have to come back next time. So it's one more place free for others. Some of you have been coming here how many years? If not here, when I go to England, when I go to Malaya, going to go to Penang, I teach all these retreats all over the place. So please, and I get you out together, get enlightened. You're taking someone else's place out of compassion for all other beings. Get out of here. It's not that easy, is it? So we'll just see what happens. Now, sometimes you just make so many plans and you arrange things and worry about things and who knows what's going to happen. Anyway, a few years ago, I applied to be a nun at Dhammasara, but I was rejected. I was a man. No, I didn't say that. I added that. A few years ago... Well, you can't sort of be discriminatory. Isn't that the open the door of your heart, no matter sort of who you are? Anyway, a few years ago, I applied to be a nun at Dhammasara, but I was rejected. I greatly admire your teaching. I'm ugly and hairy, and I do not hate men. If I had a sex change, would you ordain me as a monk? Yeah, sure. Okay, deal. Whoever wrote that question, now that was an offer, and I've accepted it, so now you have to have sex change. For honesty's purpose. You know that, I could say it anyway. You know that some years ago we always wondered about sort of how we can reinstate the bhikkhunis? And there was one thing which actually is in the texts. But you know, sometimes there is a class of people who actually have a spontaneous sex change. I had a case of this in the time of the Buddha. And actually we looked up on the internet somewhere and it can happen to a human being. It's a rare disorder. I mean, it's some genetic sort of mutation or something. But there are people who have spontaneous sex changes. Very, very, very rare. But it does happen. And because of that, you know, the Vinaya, the rules, had to sort of say, well, what happens if a person does have a sex change? If a monk has a sex change, then they don't have to reordain. They're automatically a bhikkhuni. And so when some monks saw that, they would say, let's restart the bhikkhuni order. Any volunteers? Say, no. So we found another way of doing it. But if you're ugly and hairy, well, better not go down that track. Sometimes I do go too far. Body and soul different or the same. They're different and they're the same. They're different because, you know, one is physical, the other is mental. They're the same in that there's nothing there. They're just empty phenomena which just roll on. There's no core to them. The Buddha actually said, and this is in his similes for the five candles, he said the body is like froth on the river. It's just a set of bubbles, that's all. There's nothing in it. And he said sort of, the soul, that's the two parts of it. We've got the will. The will, like the Sankaras, he said, is like an onion. As he said, it's a plantain tree. But not many people know what plantain trees are. They're banana trees. It's got no pith, no core to it. But Venerable Gunaratna, he did one better than that. I always acknowledge sort of, you know, great metaphors where they come from. He said that it's like an onion. In other words, you peel it and there's no core to it. But with an onion, it makes you cry. Will does that. You get frustrated. You know, you get sort of upset. Because, you know, after a while, you just can't get your own way and you just keep trying harder. So will, like an onion, makes you cry. An onion, it goes on and on with an I in the middle. That comes from Venugunratna. Onion. You spell it O-N-I-O-N. On and on with an I in the middle. So that was actually a very beautiful sort of simile to like the will. And that's half the soul, half what he takes on. The other one is consciousness. And he said that's a magician's trick. Now it's there, now it's gone. So it's not really real. Just like, you know, the idea of a magician is to make you look in a different place. So actually, you know, while you're looking over here, you know, the sort of the rabbit is taken out from a box and appears in his hand. So that's what a magician does. It deceives you to look in the wrong place. And that's what mind does. You're not looking in the right place. If you look at the right place, you see there's nothing there. It's just a trick, that's all. And in meditation, we learn how to look in the right place. Not out there, but in here. Because too often we look outside. We go outside. Outside this present moment. Outside the body, outside the mind. When we look inside, we see there's nothing there. In the center of you, there's a big hole. Emptiness. That's why we call this the holy life. Yes, I agree. That's a terrible joke. But I'm totally conditioned. When I do press the let and go button, I cannot recall where it is that this elusive switch resides. Pressing always seems to be the result of something out of my control. Can you please give a few clues as to where it can be found? Yes, it's found right in the very centre of the present moment. That's where you found the letting go button. So look inside the centre. Look inside the centre of the centre. Look inside the centre of the centre of the centre. And there you find the letting go button. It's not over there. It's not over here. It's right in the middle. Ajahn Brahm, the other night you said that the abuse in the Catholic Church continued because people who knew about it did not speak up. Did I say that? Oh my goodness. I'm caught out again. Many Perth Buddhist women knew about the intimidation, bullying, execution at our nuns' monastery but did not speak up. The women decided to walk away and not support the nuns' monastery rather than speak up about their own personal experience. Fortunately, after 10 years, there's new management of the nuns' monastery. 10 years is too long to wait. Sometimes it's hard to know actually that people actually did say there was some abuse at the nuns' monastery. It's not sort of physical, well, I don't know, physical abuse, but certainly there was some emotional charges of abuse. They came to the surface recently, but you know there was a change of management, and because of that, I think Dennis was dealing with that as best he possibly could. So you have to speak up when it happens, when anything happens. Please speak up, and it's very difficult to deal with, but that's where our Buddhist Society Committee and Management, that's what they're there for. So, and that's, they were dealing with that, but because of events and because there was a change of management, some illness, I think our president did contact all the people who spoke up and did sort of talk to them personally and by letter. To make them know that their complaints, what they said, were being respected, and try and find out if anything happened and what could be done about it. So there was some action taken. But obviously you don't sort of take it in such a way which is going to create more unpleasantness, but you've got to respect that if there are any accusations of abuse, they are taken seriously. We live in a modern world. And you can't just say, oh no, we've got to protect a person, we've got to protect somebody. Because you know, sometimes it's very hard to be boss of a monastery. So, you know, I have always to make sure that, you know, I am open to, look, I've abused you as well. I tell these terrible, terrible, terrible jokes. And I'm sure that, you know, that does a lot of trauma to you. But sometimes the main abuse is when you want to control people. And that's actually one of the reasons why the job, and this is important, see this in this monastery, the nuns' monastery, I've tried to impress this upon our nuns. No one is in control in that monastery. It's not an abbot. The abbot is not the boss. They're not the director. You know, you look at Bodhinyana Monastery, if you've been there, and sort of, you know, there's things go on there which I just don't know. And when we make decisions, we try and make it sort of as a group. So, you know, I'm abbot, but I'm not sort of the boss, I'm not the leader. We all have votes together. And those of you who have lived there, you know, you probably see that. We discuss things. And I'm not in control of that monastery. And it would be terrible if I was in control. Because power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So the more you have a person who's a controller, the more you're likely to have abuse. And you know that's just not even the way I meditate. I've been teaching each one of you, don't control, let things be. In this retreat, have I controlled you? Have I told you to get up at this time and get up at that time to meditate? And there's a reason I do that, because control leads to abuse. And the way I teach is the way I run that monastery. And I don't run it, basically. You know, you trust everybody. And, you know, you sort of encourage, you teach, but you never sort of scold or control. And that's the same way I meditate, and the same way I want you to meditate as well. But I can't control you. I can't tell you to meditate that way. Always remember that the Buddha's just show the way. So as a leader, as a teacher, as an abbot or an abbess, we had this joke at the beginning. It wasn't an abbess, it was an abyss. The abyss. So that's why we stopped using the word abbess. And just call, even the females abbots, because it's just too quite close to that joke. So because of that, you know, we try it. And abbot is just, you know, literally just the one with the most reins. Maybe the teacher, but not the person who decides everything. It has to be a community decision, and always getting feedback. And I've told my monks, and they've heard this, that, you know, please argue with me. If the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery never argued with me, I'd get very worried. Because it meant that they were afraid and I was too much of a control freak. So that's actually, I remember, that's how monasteries should run and should be run. If I go too far and start controlling, the next thing which will happen will be abuse. That will always happen where there's controlling. That happens in your family sometimes. And maybe a dominant person in the family is controlling everybody, and that's abuse. Control leads to abuse. It may be in your office, in the place you work, there's abuse. Because someone is dominant, they control, they think they know the best. But you're collegiate, you work together as a group, and you really do work together as a group. You may have a leader, but you know, you listen to everybody. And then it's not controlling anymore, and there you don't have abuse. Hierarchies. That's where abuse starts. That's why we try not to have hierarchies. The best we possibly can. So anyway, that's... Thank you for that. It's a hard question, Master. Yes?
This business of obedience to authority, it's manifested itself in the society, which you're talking about. But this is a big deal. Mm. This is a big deal. Philip Zimbardo wrote back in the 70s that people will kill under instruction from authority. That claim is an execution experiment.
Yeah.
They did a recent survey on in Australia, and they asked people, if you knew that one of your children was being sexually abused by your partner, would you report it to authorities? And more than 50% people said no, they wouldn't.
Yep.
So this issue is not necessarily
if you look at it from a Buddhist perspective, the only thing you can do is to get rid of those five hindrances as soon as possible. So, you know, you're not going through desire, you're not going through ill will, you're seeing things as they truly are. You know that second hindrance of ill will, it's denial. You won't see what's truly there because it's just too awful to see, it's too troublesome, and you just can't bear to make more problems in your life. You've already got enough. So, you know, I'm not seeing this. And desire is where you just want it to be different. You live in a world of what you want to see, what you want to have, what you want to be. you're not being real. So now that very strong honesty, which can only come when those hindrances are actually overcome, that's the first step. And because those hindrances only come by deep meditation, we're going to have a world which is like that. That's going to always be there. Basically, you know, because we've got our defilements, there'll always be abuse. That's the nature of the beast. So our job is to see if we can minimize that as much as possible. And the only way, you know, to have that, again, is to people being honest, speaking out, and to have procedures in place. Because sometimes people speak out and they're just, you know, they're acting out of illusional will that you haven't abused, you haven't done anything. You know, it's just people just sour grapes or just trying to destroy you. So you've got to be careful there that an abuse shouldn't just be believed because it's abuse. It has to be investigated, and it's a tough thing to do, and sometimes not the resources to do that. But at least we should try and speak out. And one of the things which, you know, as a leader of a group, always that as long as people are heard, it's really important. One of the first things is to listen to people, and never sort of, you know, dismiss people because what you think they're saying is silly or it can't be true. So when people are actually speaking to you, you know, to respect what they're saying, listen to it first of all. It may be wrong, it may be sort of coming from a crazy person, but listen to it first of all. Assume, you know, that it's worth listening to first of all. Give it respect before you dismiss it. Or before you follow up on it if you find out to be true. That's the meaning of that saying, if someone calls you a dog, look at your bottom, see if you've got a tail. It doesn't mean they call you a dog, I'm not a dog, you know, you're just in a bad mood. You see if you have got a tail, to see if there is, you've made a mistake. If you have, then do something about it. If there is a mistake in your community, do something about it if you possibly can. I don't know if that really helps, but at least to listen anyway. Because that's one of the most frustrating things, when people say there's abuse and no one's listening, and no one will take them seriously. You know, at least, you know, if you take them seriously and you say, look, it's very difficult to do something right now, at least they've been taken seriously. You know, even with the nuns sing, you know, the bhikkhuni ordination, it was just so hard for me to be listened to about what really happened in Perth. And still people got some really weird ideas of what happened with that bhikkhuni ordination. And so they don't listen. And that's one of the most frustrating things. So anyway, it's very serious this evening, so hardly any jokes, but got some very important matters. Why is it that sometimes after a pretty long and quite peaceful meditation I'd be a little inner monologue, and when I come out of meditation for a short time I can't seem to remember who I am or where I am? Great! Anatta! If it's really a peaceful meditation and you really get enlightened, then that state is permanent. You don't know where you are or who I am. At last I'm free. Where are you anyway? You know, I go around the world and travel in many places. You know, wherever I go, there I am. I'm always here. It's you guys are sometimes not here, that's all. But I know where I always am. I'm here. What's that old joke about this old farmer? He was ploughing his field and one of these hot air balloons came overhead. And the hot air balloonist was lost. And so he shouted down to the farmer, "Where am I?" And the farmer says, "You're up there." It's all right. So I mean, that's what I am. I'm always here. And who am I? Nothing. Empty. That's his emptiness. But it's only a short while. This has happened to me in a few times. And also to a friend of mine. It's brilliant. Enjoy it. It's so nice, you know, not existing. A few years ago, I applied to be... I've got that one already. Oh, that's right, I'll put those back in there. I'm taking out the ones I've already done. Okay, oh, this is a good question. Let's do a deal. You give me the winning lottery numbers, and I will give you 10% of the winnings. No, let's negotiate. I mean, I do all the work. I give you the lottery number. I only get 10%. So is that really worth it? No, you get 10%, I get 90%. The trouble is that, you know, the people, they win the lottery, and, you know, they take it all. They never give me the 10%. Really mean of them. I give it to the Buddhist Society, and they spend it on something, I don't know. Anyway, no. Win lottery numbers. Somebody gave me an article. You did, didn't it? No, who did? Somebody gave me an article, and it was about this, I know it's actually Noon from Thailand, and I think you put it on the internet for me, Daniel did, about this person who won lottery in England. I think it's 60 or 70 million pounds or something. And the first thing they did was build a big house, a big mansion. And then they've recently sold their mansion because they can't find their kids in the mansion. It's got so many rooms, and they want to find their son, their daughter, and just have to send out a search party. It was actually true, the article was, because they realised that there's such a big place, it was just splitting up the family. And I've said that many times. I went to a house over with Shelley by the river there, and I went all the way from Serpentine, which was an hour's trip, and I went into the room and sat down, and it was a Dana blessing, and I said, I need to go to the toilet. I've been an hour's journey. They drew me a map. They did, of how to get to the toilet. That's how big the house was. That's why modern mansions, if you actually have a look at these big mansions which are sold these days, they come with free GPS. During meditation, when mind leaves the body, what will happen if that mind cannot enter the body again? Maybe my body is already cremated. Ah, thank you. So in meditation, actually, the mind doesn't leave the body. It just goes deep inside. So the body is still there. It hasn't gone to the west or the east or anywhere. So it's still inside, but it's deep inside. And at that time, your body can't be burned. So now, if they did think you were dead, when you were in jhana, and they took you to the crematorium, and they put you in the oven, say, when they take you out, you're still there. It'd be really weird, wouldn't it? And that would probably get in the newspaper, you'd probably be famous. But anyway, that's probably what happens, according to me. But you're staying here when you have an out-of-the-body experience, when you leave the body. Now, I did mention about that person. This is an interview with her on a documentary. When she actually left her body, she was having such a wonderful time. She didn't want to come back. And that's where that spirit, I told you, told her, you must come back. She said, I don't want to, but you must. No way. And he took hold of her and threw her back in. And that's why he's really upset at that spirit. So when he says when she dies again, she's going to search out that guy and just really give it to him. Because it's so nice outside your body. So if that happens to you, your mind leaves the body, and you'll be very happy you can't get back in again. It's like, imagine a person escapes from prison, and they can't get back in again. Wow! I'll take that. Please, Ajahn, how does the process of reincarnation work? Well, first of all, you die. That's the first step, to be reincarnated. And then the next thing is, where do you want to get reborn? Now, it's just like, say you're planning your holidays next year. Where do you want to go on holiday next year? Paris? London? Sort of Bali? Or back here to Jhana Grove? Now, to be able to get back here to the next retreat, you have to have two things. You have to want to come here. Some people have had enough already. They just can't wait till Sunday to get out of here. So if you really want to come back again, that's the first cause for coming back next time. And the second is, you've got the good luck, or you're skilled enough in that computer to actually get a place in the next retreat. So one is like the will, the other one is your good karma. Those two come together and you get back on this retreat. The same with reincarnation. Where you get reborn is where you want to get reborn, as long as you've got enough good karma to get there. So the combination of your karma and your desire, craving and the karma, those two together will define where you get reborn. Some people here told me some years ago, they've made lots of good karma, so they've chose where they want to get reborn next time. They want to get reborn here in Perth, as a dog. Why a dog? I asked them. Because they don't like going to work on a Monday morning. And dogs don't have to go to work. They can sleep around all day. They get fed really nice food. And all they have to do is to go for a walk and get petted. So that's just what I want to do in my next life. Just get stroked every now and again. Get looked after, nice food. And not have to do any work, no responsibility. No stress. Imagine being a dog. You've got no stress at all. But then I told this guy, he said, well, in Perth, most dogs, especially male dogs, they have to go to the vet, first of all. And they said, I don't want to be a dog anymore. So what do you want to be in your next life? Do you want to be a rabbit, Danny? It's nice being a rabbit. You can, you know, live in Jarna Grove for a long time. You like Jarna Grove. You just hop around a little bit and eat. Great fun. So whatever you want, be careful, because what you want, sometimes you get. So be careful. That's actually how reincarnation works. The combination of craving and karma. During my meditation, I saw a lot of my weaknesses, like wanting people to follow my way, jealousy, ego, etc. I felt I am an unwholesome person. I felt guilt. Okay, that's when you just see the two bad bricks in your wall. But you've got thousands of good bricks in the wall. So sometimes you get the fault-finding mind. You look at yourself and think, oh, I just want people to follow my way. It's like me. I just want everyone to become enlightened. I want everyone to become Buddhist. I want everybody to follow my type of Buddhism. I want everybody to follow my type of meditation. I want everybody to become monks and nuns. I want everybody to like fish and chips. I want everybody... How come you don't like fish and chips? You must be crazy. But what's happening there is you see that stupidity. So when you feel it's actually stupidity or jealousy, I just let that go. I just laugh at it, make a joke of it. And instead, when I see beautiful things in me, those are the ones I really cherish. So look at yourself. Yeah, you got your guilty stuff. But let that go. Look at all the beautiful things in you. You're a meditator. You know, you're a Buddhist. You've really done lots of good karma. You've worked so hard. You've done so much dharma, so much generosity. You've been working so hard for the Buddhist society. You've been contributing, building this place, helping people. Wow, what a great person you are. So look at the 998 good bricks. The 9,998. The 9.99 to the... Well, the 9 to the 10 to the 99th. Bricks in your good wall, and you find actually that way you realize, actually, I'm not that bad after all. And when you see all your good qualities, you know that you're worthy of forgiveness, which means all your bad qualities are totally overwhelmed by all your good qualities, which means you can let the bad qualities go. If you have an apple which is 90% rotten, you'll throw it away. If you have an apple which is only 1% rotten, oh, you just take that one bit out and eat the rest. Just like you. You're 99% beautiful. So eat that part. Okay, they've got that one away. Dear Ajahn, can we take food cooked in alcohol? And they've got little in brackets. Cooked in alcohol... yeah, of course you can. They do have actually fish and beer batter. They do. But you all know if they actually cook it in alcohol, it just sort of evaporates. So as long as it's cooked after the alcohol is added, okay. But not alcohol added after it's cooked. Then you're in big trouble. Because you know, sometimes as monks, you give us all this food, we don't know what it is. And sometimes we get a bit sort of suspicious. You know, when it smells of alcohol. And there was one case, there was these monks, and actually many of them are quite famous. They got there from Canada, and their mother, or one of them, their mother sent them some wine gums from Canada. And they thought wine gums are just sweets. They didn't realize they had actually real wine in it. And these four monks got drunk. This was a Wat Nanat Chart in the first couple of years. So we had four drunk monks in the monastery. simply because, you know, that someone had put wine in the wine gums and they thought the wine gums were just sweet, but actually real wine in it. So you've got to be really careful these days. You know, people put plonk in everything. So because of that, we have to be very, very, very careful as monks. So, and you have to be careful feeding us monks. So don't just spike it for a joke, because we don't know what we're eating. You know, so please, you know, sort of don't sort of, you know, put sort of the whiskey over the chips, or whatever you do. So, you know, we trust you people, so be careful. So as long as the food, the alcohol is put in first and then cooked, then it's okay. What if it produces so much alcohol that it's actually discernible, then we can't eat it? So, because it's going to make you drunk. And as every person knows, just even a small amount of alcohol actually wrecks your mindfulness. That's why that for many jurisdictions now, the alcohol level for driving is zero. They're bringing it to zero, because even a little bit of alcohol messes up your reaction time and also your awareness. So you're actually danger to driving. And that's actually a real problem, because I will never forget the one time I performed a funeral service for a Chinese girl. It was one of the most saddest funerals I've been to. This Chinese girl, you know, from mainland China, she'd studied really hard. Her two parents, only single child, no single child policy. Single child, she'd studied hard and she managed to sort of get to university, and then she got a scholarship to study here in Australia. Brilliant kid who'd worked so hard to get a life. And after about being here for 2 or 3 months, she invited her parents for a holiday. And her parents had only arrived maybe one day. And she was walking down one of the, on the pavement in Kelmscott, just north of here. It's one of the southern suburbs of Perth. And a drunk driver lost control of the car, came up on the sidewalk and killed this little girl. And the two parents, you know, they're at the funeral, they couldn't understand English. And I've never seen parents so devastated. You know, their child was their life. Much more so than, you know, if your child died, the only one they had. And this was all their hopes, their dreams, all their hard work was put into this one person. A whole lot. And now that young girl was killed because of a stupid person drinking alcohol and driving. When you saw the amount of pain that caused, you know, you can't really have any sympathy for drink drivers. It's a really stupid thing to do. It's just when you see what the pain it can cause. So zero alcohol in drink driving is probably a good idea. If it's cooked and baked before you eat it, then the brandy disappears. It's just got the smell, but it's not got the alcohol anymore. Because alcohol just evaporates very quickly when it's heated. So, but sometimes people put the alcohol on after. And that's the problem over there. If they ignite it, that's the bon flambe. I remember I went to a restaurant with my girlfriend once just to impress her. I got this waiter to do that. It was really impressive. But, you know, it's on the crepe flambe. They put all this brandy on and just this waiter almost blew himself up. He wasn't very good, but it was actually a nice thing to do. I always remember that. I didn't like it, but it was just, you know, the drama of the whole thing was why I paid such a huge amount for it. But anyway, that burns off the alcohol as well. And sometimes you wonder, why are people so obsessed with alcohol? You have much more fun without it. And it's expensive. So you can have a great party without alcohol. As many of you, you know, you come around here, we have great fun here for this retreat. And, you know, the parties we have here when we have these big ceremonies of Katina Day or Ajahn Brahm's party every sort of Christmas Eve, people have a great time. It's not one drop of alcohol. It's a way of proving that you don't need alcohol to have a good time. It's much safer without it. Last questions. Actually, can you have the lights dimmed? This is an unseen being question. Could you dim the lights, please, Nicholas? Yes. Okay, good. It's more like it. Very good. Very good. Oh, power down. Can unseen beings or devas, can they understand English? This is Australia, not your accent. So if a ghost comes into your hut this evening and you say, go out, they won't understand you because it's Aussie ghost and your accent is too thick. Some Bhantes say they can. Some Bhantes say they can only understand Pali. That's why we chant in Pali. Not in Australia. Aussie ghosts don't understand Pali. So your chanting is not going to work. Ooh. The reason why Pali chanting is very good for getting rid of ghosts, especially the monks of Bodhinyana Monastery, the reason is because our chanting, especially when we join together, is usually out of key. And the ghosts can't stand it. They go out, ah! This is terrible. But imagine if it was very beautiful Pali chanting. No, they'll stay a long time. Oh, this is beautiful. It's so peaceful and soothing. That's why our chanting is the best to get rid of ghosts, because they can't stand it after a few minutes. No, the real beings and devas, actually, they can't understand English or Pali. They understand your thoughts. So it's mind to mind. That's the language. These are mind-made beings. And this is actually what they understand. And when I was teaching the last retreat for the Singaporeans, one day they asked me, it's in the bottom of the pile here, can you please tell us a ghost story? So I told this story to them. And I actually repeat it on a Friday night. Those of you on a Friday night and heard me tell this story, please bear with me. There was a man who was walking home from the temple one day. He had to pass the cemetery. There's no other way back to his home. And he always felt a bit ill at ease passing the cemetery. And I don't know why this is, but on the streets they have street lamps. But when you get to the cemetery, there are either no street lamps or they're very, very far apart. It's always much darker when you go past the graveyard. So he'd been past the graveyard many times, but again, he was always very happy when he got past it. He was halfway past, everything was going okay. 3/4 of the way past, fine. But he hadn't got all the way past when he started hearing the sound of something following him. Now you may have done that at night time, coming home by yourself, and you think that someone's following you. What do you do? You don't look round, do you? Because you're afraid of what you might see. Instead, you just walk a little bit faster. But not too fast, in case the thing following you knows you're scared. That's what he did. He walked a little bit faster. But he was listening intently behind him. Whatever was following him also started coming faster. And so he really increased his step. And of course, when you're afraid, your awareness gets very acute. He listened, and it wasn't stepping. It was bumping. Bump, bump, bump after him. And so he started running. Bump, 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 bump. Even though he was afraid to see what this thing was, he couldn't help himself but turn around. And you can imagine his terror when what he saw following him was a coffin. A vertical coffin with all the cobwebs on. Bump, bump, bump. Following him down the road. He broke into a sweat. He ran as fast as he possibly could. His house was close by. But when he started running faster, bump, 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 the coffin started following him too. And he was desperate. He was at his front door. He dropped his keys. Because that's what you do when you panic. And the coffin was almost upon him. He managed to get his keys. He was really lucky. The first time the key went into the lock, opened the lock, opened the door, got inside and slammed the door just as the coffin came to the door. And he breathed a sigh of relief. He'd locked the door. And he could see through the glass in the door. The coffin was on the other side. But he was safe. He was at home. Bump! Bump! As the coffin started hitting the door. Bump! As the hinges started to give way. Bump! As the wood began to split. Bump! He ran up the stairs. He was hot to the landing halfway up when the coffin broke through. Bump! And smashed the door down. And he saw the coffin, and the coffin saw him. Bump, bump, bump up the stairs. He ran ahead of it. The only room with a lock was the bathroom. He went in there and locked the door. And the coffin followed him to the outside of the door. Bump! Bump! Against the bathroom door. He knew it was only a matter of time when the coffin broke through. Bump! And the bathroom door shattered. He had no other place to go. His back was literally against the wall of the bathroom as the coffin came for him. He reached out anything to defend himself. He was very lucky. He picked up this bottle of medicine, threw it at the coffin, and the coffin stopped. It was cough medicine. Guaranteed to stop the coffin. Okay, no cough medicine, guaranteed to stop the coffin. Okay, after such a serious talk about all sorts of abuse and stuff, I have now abused you totally with that terrible joke. If you don't want to say three sadhus, I totally understand. If you do want to say three sadhus, okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So good night, everybody, and nice dreams. Okay.